thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my respected friends. Our lecture this evening is a somewhat interesting one because it embraces a very important part of the purpose of God as outlined in the Bible. I'm going to say at the outset that we're going to cover quite a bit of material tonight, and so I wanted to say something by way of comfort and reassurance right at the beginning of our remarks. You are not going to remember everything I say tonight. I don't expect you to remember everything that we're going to say tonight from the scriptural record. In fact, the only thing that we really want you to remember tonight as you go away is an overwhelming sense of the fact that the Bible record has perhaps more to it than meets the eye. That the Bible is perhaps a more interesting document than you first imagined. That perhaps the whole matter of the resurrection of Christ is not something that you can simply dispense with as a fable of Christianity. And so it doesn't matter that we don't remember all the detail that I'm going to give you, but I hope that in the very giving of that detail, you'll grasp some sense of the overwhelming power and majesty of the testimony of the Bible on this particular subject, so great and so important it is. Now, I'm going to start this evening by trying to point out to you why I believe the resurrection of Christ was such an enormously important thing in the purpose of God. You see, before we talk about the fact that Christ rose from the dead, we really want to know, well, why was it? Why was it so important that this took place? And I think that I can satisfactorily say for you this evening, from God's point of view and from the Bible's point of view, the whole purpose of God pivoted on this great thing, that the Son of God be raised from the dead. Now, just consider this evidence, none of which we have time to look up, but all of which is terribly compelling if you have the time to actually think it through. You see, for all of these reasons, the resurrection of Christ was the pivotal point in the purpose of God. The first thing is that the resurrection of Christ was the seal of God's approval of the teaching of his Son, of the work of his Son, of the sacrifice of his Son. You see, this man, Jesus Christ, claimed that he would rise from the dead. This man claimed with all that he had done that people ought to believe him if he rose from the dead. This man was prepared to have everything that he said tested by this one fact. And so the resurrection of Christ was the seal of God's approval on everything that Christ had ever taught and said and done. And it was more than simply God's approval, it was the proof of God's justice. Because what had been involved here was the death of an innocent and perfectly righteous man. And to have left him dead in the tomb would have been deemed to have been a gross miscarriage of justice. And God's own justice, therefore, demanded in the outworking of his purpose that Jesus Christ be raised from the dead. It was a proof of God's justice in the matter. And it was also the triumph of God's victory. Because one of the great objectives of this matter was the final and absolute proof that the law of sin and death had been irrevocably, absolutely, gloriously overcome. And the best proof of that was not that a man lie dead in the tomb, but that he rise from the dead to show that death finally had been destroyed and overcome. This was the triumph of God's victory. How could he not raise Jesus from the dead? It was to be the extension of God's grace in making provision for the forgiveness of sins. The very act of the resurrection of Christ is cited over and over again in the New Testament record as being absolutely crucially linked to the matter of the forgiveness of sins that God would provide in his grace through the raising of this one. It was to be the evidence of God's care that all who put their trust in him may have the same hope of ultimate resurrection from the dead, bodily resurrection from the dead, that just as God had raised his Son, so he would and could raise others. And that he had that principle of care as shown in the death and in the mighty resurrection of his own Son. We believe, in addition to that, that it was the outpouring of God's love. This was the exaltation of his own obedient and beloved Son. How the Father must have loved to step forward and to provide life again to this dead body. His only Son, his only begotten and well-beloved Son. Oh yes, this was the outpouring of a Father's love for his own child in the resurrection of this one from the dead. It was the gift of God's mercy. Because in addition to providing a perfect sacrifice for sins, it was in the plan of God that he also provide an immortal intercessor, an immortal priest, and an everlasting king. And all of that meant that this one, this offering, had to be raised from the dead. It was the gift of God's mercy, this resurrection of this one. It was the token of God's faithfulness, because he'd made great promises in the past to the fathers of the Jewish race, and every one of those depended on the resurrection of this particular man from the dead. All those promises would fall to the ground unless this one were raised. It was the token of God's faithfulness for all that he had promised in the past. It was to be the assurance of God's power, the assurance that ultimately others would be raised to newness of life, and that the hope of the Bible, the hope of the time to come, the hope for all mankind, was the hope of a bodily resurrection to a newness of life, all exhibited and set forth in representation in the raising of his own Son as the demonstration of God's mighty power. And finally, it was to be the demonstration of God's wisdom in forever enshrining a moral principle that just as Jesus had died, and that so also we must die to the things of the thinking of mankind, that as Jesus was raised, so we should be raised to the thinking of God's ways. Death to the old way, life to the new way. All of this was going to be exhibited in the resurrection of Jesus. Oh yes, it was a demonstration of God's wisdom. Such a terribly important thing, my dear friends, that this particular resurrection take place. Absolutely pivotal to the purpose of God. For all of these reasons, absolutely vital that the resurrection of Jesus take place. And what we've said tonight, I suppose it's a fairly brave title in a way, isn't it? Indisputable evidence that Christ was raised from the dead. Well, let's have a look at the evidence, shall we? Because what we're going to try and do this evening is to have a look at the gospel records and to sit for ourselves in judgment on the matter. We're going to act as judge and jury. And you see, in such a case as this, the contemporary letters and documents that relate to that particular era would be accepted by a judge as valid evidence to be used in coming to his conclusion. He would accept documents of that period as forming part of the information that he would sift in making a decision on the matter. And one of the things that we do know about the gospel writers in the New Testament is that some of the facts that they recorded, they would not always be aware of the real significance of them. They wrote them down. They didn't always understand themselves how terribly important they were. And you see, in examining evidence of this nature, a judge would sift material, and where information from separate sources provided agreement concurrently in an undesigned way, then he would regard this as helping to validate and authenticate both sources of evidence. Where documents from different people and from different eyewitnesses unconsciously agreed with one another, the judge would accept that as useful in authenticating the truth of those particular comments. And the last thing, of course, is that any conclusion reached needs to harmonize all the evidential facts. A good and wise judge, when he's weighing up a matter, can't make a decision based on one piece of evidence if it's clearly at variance with another piece of evidence. The judgment to be made is after sifting and weighing all the facts, and then making a judgment that is the most consistent with all the information available in the case. And so I invite you to sit with me as judge in the matter. as the gospel records of the New Testament now bring forth their evidence in the case and in the matter of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Now here are the facts. Let's examine them together. So the first thing is the matter of the dead body. I'd like you to come with me to the Gospel of Luke chapter 23. Now in the Gospel of Luke chapter 23, we're told these words in the 46th verse. It says, "And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost," or gave up the spirit, "gave up his life. And when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, Certainly this was a righteous man. And all the people that came together to that sight, beholding the things which were done, smote their breasts and returned." Now, I want you to take notice of this fact, my dear friends, that in Luke 23 and verses 46 and 47, the Roman centurion who was on duty for the matter of this particular death was a personal witness of the death of this man. He was there at the very time that Jesus died. Did you notice that? Verse 46, "He gave up the spirit, and when the centurion saw what was done," he was there at the precise moment. He didn't have it by report. He had it personally. He saw the matter personally in that particular matter. Now, Mark chapter 15. The Gospel of Mark chapter 15 says this. We're told that a man requested the body of Jesus a little later on. And in Mark 16, we read these words in the 42nd verse. "And now when the even was come," this is a different writer now, this is a different document that we're examining, this is the Gospel of Mark. "When the even was come," chapter 15, verse 42, "because it was the preparation," that is the day before the Sabbath, "Joseph of Arimathea, an honourable counsellor, which also waited for the kingdom of God, came and went in boldly unto Pilate, and craved the body of Jesus. And Pilate marvelled if he were already dead. And calling unto him the centurion, he asked him whether he had been any while dead. And when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body to Jesus." Now you see, the centurion would be a man experienced at both witnessing and verifying dead bodies. That was part of his job as a Roman soldier. He'd seen plenty of dead bodies before. But you see, in this particular case, he's asked for specific confirmation by the Roman governor that the body was dead, and the centurion confirmed that it was so. And that's the force, by the way, of the word body in verse 45. When it says he gave the body to Joseph, what it really means is he gave the corpse to Joseph. It was a dead body. And the centurion had given information concerning that. Yes, I don't think there's any doubt from the gospel records that the body really was dead. Now, the next piece of evidence is the question of the burial itself. So come and have a look at John chapter 19. So now we've got a dead body and we want to know what to do with it and where to put it. And what do the gospel records say about the matter of the burial itself? Well, John 19 says this, verse 41. John 19, the last two verses. "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new sepulchre, wherein was never man yet laid. There laid they Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulchre was nigh at hand." So I want you to notice the details given concerning the tomb. Firstly, it's a privately owned tomb in a specific garden. In fact, a new sepulchre wherein never has there been a dead body before. So it's quite specific, really, the details about the tomb. And if you come to Matthew 27, we'll find an even more specific detail about the particular burial place. Because this is what we're told in Matthew 27. Matthew 27 says, and verse 60, concerning this sepulchre in the garden, Matthew 27, verse 60, Joseph laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre and departed. So this is a tomb that's actually hewn out of solid rock. This was a common practice in those days, was to carve the tomb out of solid rock. And inside the tomb, on one wall, there would be a ledge carved out, carved right out of the rock, a ledge on which the body would lie. And the outside edge of the ledge was carved upwards with just a little curve so that the body could not roll off the ledge onto the floor. And if one imagines the length of the ledge that way, where the head ought to be, there was a raised bit so that the head would be just slightly higher than the body, and so it would sit naturally on the carving of the solid rock. Well, such was the sepulchre here in Matthew chapter 27, verse 60. In fact, we're told that it's it's Joseph's own sepulchre. Just an interesting aside, by the way. Do you know that at the birth of Jesus, there was a man called Joseph? There was a woman called Mary? There was a virgin womb, and there were swaddling clothes. And in the gospel record of Matthew, in verse 59, at the time of the death of Jesus, there is a Joseph, verse 59. There is a Mary, verse 61. There is a virgin tomb, verse 60. And there are burying linen garments, verse 59. Something tremendously poetical about the story here of the death of Jesus. It almost somehow echoes the story of the birth of this man earlier on in the record. And so now we've got a dead body which has been laid on a rock slab in the burial tomb that belonged to Joseph. And here's the next piece of evidence. We've also got the stone. Well, now that stone's mentioned in verse 60 here. It says here, he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre. Actually, if you want to know how great it was, in one of the other gospels, one of the manuscripts adds a little comment to one of the other gospels and says that it was a stone which 20 men could not roll away. That's quite a big stone. 20 men would find difficulty in rolling this stone away. Of course, what it was a disc, wasn't it? It was a large stone disc, and there was a trench or a channel cut in front of the sepulchre, and into that channel this enormous stone would be rolled and pushed until finally it was rolled right in front of the sepulchre opening, sealing it off completely. This enormous stone there to seal or to close the burial tomb. Do you know what I think, my dear friends? I think that a large stone suited everybody in this particular story. You think about the drama of this particular death as the gospel records present them. I think it suited Joseph that the body be securely buried in this particular tomb. I think it suited the disciples that the body was known to be safely buried with no chance of anyone else getting at it, particularly the Jews. I think it suited Pilate, the Roman governor, and I think it suited the Jewish people in particular, the Jewish leaders. It ensured with greatest certainty that this particular body, once in this tomb, with that stone rolled, would be left alone. I think that's what everybody wanted. I think that rings absolutely true when you consider the actual circumstances of this particular case as it had arisen in Israel, in Jerusalem, at this time. there wasn't just a stone. There was something else, because the record tells us there was also the seal. The seal over the stone. Now, you see what it says? In verse 64, command therefore that the sepulchre be made sure unto the third day. Verse 65, Pilate said unto them, ye have a watch, go your way, make it as sure as ye can. And then verse 66 finally explains what it means by making the sepulchre sure. It says in verse 66, so they went and made the sepulchre sure. How did they do that? Well, they sealed the stone. They sealed the stone. Actually, if you come back to the book of Daniel and to the 6th chapter of Daniel in the Old Testament, we have a very similar circumstance there, albeit relating to a different governing power. In the Old Testament and in the book of Daniel, in chapter 6, we read these words on an earlier occasion. Daniel 6, verse 16, the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. And the king spake and said unto Daniel, thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and here it is, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. The king sealed it with his own signet. Now, if we come back to Matthew, I believe that that's exactly what happened on this particular occasion. Let me tell you what the Roman custom was when a tomb was to be sealed. So imagine we've got the tomb door right here, just over here, and the stone has been rolled in front of it. Well, what they would do is on one side of the tomb, they would slap a piece of clay on the stone wall. And into that piece of clay, they would bury a rope. And then they would take the rope right across the face of the stone and then slap a piece of clay on the far side and embed the rope into that piece of clay so that that piece of rope hangs straight across the burial place and right across the great stone that had been rolled in front of the sepulchre. And having buried that rope in a piece of clay on either side, they then sealed it. And you see that word sealed in verse 66? The word means to stamp with a signet. And I believe that the signet that was stamped upon it on this occasion was the very seal of the Roman governor himself, Pilate. And the seal of the governor was stamped into that clay on both sides of that tomb. And what that signet said to all the world was that anybody that tampers with this tomb meddles with the Roman authority and brings down upon them all the authority and punishment of the Roman system upon them. Who do you think would have wanted to meddle with that tomb and that seal on that day? And you see, again, I think that this seal actually suited everybody. The disciples wanted the Lord's body protected against desecration by the Jews. The Jews wanted the tomb sealed as a measure against the disciples. Pilate wanted the tomb sealed to guarantee that there would be no collusion by the guards. The guard? Oh yes, the guard. That's right, that's the next piece of evidence, really, isn't it? There were guards involved in this particular matter. And here they are. Where is it that we shall look for the guards? Matthew 27, again, verse 65 says, ye have a watch, go your way, make it as sure as ye can. Now, we're not told what sort of watch it was. It could have been a Jewish watch, or it could have been a Roman watch. My personal inclination was that it was actually a Roman guard on this occasion. There are two reasons for assuming that. Firstly, the word here in the Bible is a Latin word, custodia. It's not a Hebrew word, it's not a Greek word. The New Testament being written in Greek, it's actually a Latin word. And one imagines that a Latin word is used because it was a Latin guard or a Roman guard. And the second thing is, we're going to find later on in this chapter that this Roman guard reported to the Roman governor, which they wouldn't have done if they were simply Jewish. But no, they're responsible to the Roman governor, says Matthew 28 a little later on in the story. Now, I don't know how much you know about Roman history and Roman things, but what I do know is that there were certain sort of duties that guards had, and they breached them. They really didn't want to breach them, actually. The reward for sleeping on duty as a Roman guard was instant death. It was quite an incentive to stay awake. The only thing that a Roman guard had in mind, believe me, they had no interest in that body whatsoever. They had every interest in staying awake. They had a greater interest in their own body, to be precise. And the Gospels tell us that there was a guard there. And they were very alert, believe me. Oh, and what about this? Now, this is a very interesting piece of evidence. The grave clothes. The letters and documents of the period tell us that this particular body was wrapped in grave clothes. In fact, what the Jews favoured as grave clothes were old Torah coverings. That was the favourite thing for a pious Jew to be wrapped in for the purposes of his death and burial, was to be wrapped in old Torah coverings. And they would wrap the body in these linen wrappings, and we're told in the Gospel records that they then sprinkled myrrh and aloes upon the wrappings. Now, I don't know if you know much about myrrh and aloes, but I know this, that when those things were sprinkled in the wrappings, that by the time the body was completely wrapped up, it's all glued together like cement. The whole body is encased in these wrappings, all stuck to the body. In fact, we're told in one of the records that the spices alone weighed 100 pounds. That's an awful lot of spices. That's an awful lot of glue. So now, I want you to think about what we've done or what we've seen so far in terms of the evidence that the Gospel writers provide for this particular matter. We've got a corpse. It's been interred. The whole body is glued in wrappings. The grave's been closed. An enormous stone shuts the entrance. There's a seal securing the stone. There's a guard watching the seal. In fact, this is a remarkable story, and I'll tell you why. Because, you see, when you read all these facts and put them all together, there really is no opportunity for trickery or for foul play in this particular case. The very precautions taken will provide the greatest proof that the resurrection must have occurred. Because there's too many checks and balances here. There's too many things that they did to prevent hanky-panky from occurring. And there's going to be a great difficulty then in explaining the next piece of evidence which the Gospels provide. And the next piece of evidence is this. That a little while later, the said tomb was rather remarkably empty. In fact, if you come to Matthew 28, just over the page, we're told this. I want you to notice these words, because I think they're terribly important. If I was a judge, I'd give great weight to this evidence. In Matthew 28 and verse 12, perhaps verse 11, it says, "Now when they were going, behold, some of the watch came into the city and showed unto the chief priests all the things that were done. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole them away while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you. And so they took the money and did as they were taught. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day." You know what's remarkable about Matthew 28, my dear friends? I'll tell you what's remarkable. The one indisputable fact that nobody, absolutely nobody in Jerusalem at this time argued was that the tomb was empty. Even the Jews began their endeavours to try and sort out the explanation with the assumption that the tomb definitely was empty. No one debated that, not even the Jews. They didn't want it to be empty. They were very upset that it was empty, but they accepted it was empty. Do you know that every Jewish writing since Matthew 28 has implicitly accepted the fact of the empty tomb? That's remarkable. Nobody could dispute the emptiness of the tomb. Interesting thing, you know, that if Jesus had died in this tomb and his body had been interred somewhere else, or something else had happened to him, and his people and his followers had wanted to remember him and to memorialize him, this would have become an excellent shrine, wouldn't it? The tomb of Jesus, the great leader, the great teacher. You know, this would have been the sort of place, a shrine where pilgrims would come to pay their respects. Funny thing, you know, but the tomb never became a great shrine for the followers of Jesus. Do you know why it never became a great shrine? Because it really was empty, and because he really wasn't there. Well, we're almost finished in terms of the evidence. Here's the last two, the appearances. Now, I'm going to push that up just a little. No, I'll take it off, and then you can see both things simultaneously. So, the appearances. The fact is that the records tell us that there were a number of appearances of Jesus to people after the empty tomb. He appeared to Mary, he appeared to two disciples on the road to Emmaus, he appeared to the apostles once without Thomas, he appeared to the apostles with Thomas, he appeared to Peter, he appeared to the seven, he appeared to James, he appeared to Paul, he appeared to John, he appeared to the 500. There's an enormous number of appearances of this man after the tomb was empty. So whatever you do in terms of making a judgment on this matter, you've got to somehow account for the appearances, you see. How would you explain the evidence of the appearances? And the last thing, which is perhaps psychologically the most compelling piece of evidence of all, the transformed disciples, the men that were so scared, so terrified at the time of the death of Jesus, who then were going to turn into giants and who would go forth and transform the entire world with the preaching of this message, he is risen from the dead. How do you account for those transformed men? If they knew that all they were doing was a terrible lie, and that all they were living was a lie that they themselves had concocted. So this is the evidence, you see, that we're trying to examine now and to come to a conclusion on. It's been very brief, I'm sorry for the speed of that, but we've got to move on, you see, because now we've got to try and come to some conclusions in the matter. Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take you through the various conclusions that have been drawn concerning that evidence that we have just briefly examined from the gospel records. I'm going to ask you to form your own judgment, to make your own decisions, and I'm going to take you through each of the main theories that's been drawn up to account for the fact that Jesus really didn't rise from the dead. This is really the decisions of those who are not happy to accept the resurrection of Christ from the dead. So, well, here's the first idea. Some of you may have heard of this. It's called the wrong tomb theory. Now, what this idea is that there is a lot of rock tombs around Jerusalem, and it would be pretty easy for the woman to make a mistake and to go to a tomb that was empty and to mistakenly imagine that that was the one that Jesus ought to have been in. But in fact, they got it wrong. They went to the wrong place, you see. In fact, the suggestion's been made that they came to a young man who guessed their errand and told them of their mistake and pointed out another tomb where he was, that Jesus wasn't in this tomb, he was in that one. He pointed to another tomb elsewhere because they'd actually made a mistake. The wrong tomb theory. Interesting idea. So let's go back to the Gospels, shall we? John chapter 19, let's start with. Now, I think we'll go straight to Luke 23. Luke 23. The wrong tomb theory. Well, what do you think of this evidence then? In Luke 23, we're told this in verse 54. And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. And the women also, which came with him from Galilee, followed after, and beheld the sepulchre. They beheld how his body was laid. They returned and prepared spices and ointments, and rested the Sabbath day according to the command. Actually, we're told in another place that before the body went into the tomb, that Joseph and Nicodemus had already anointed the body with myrrh and aloes as they wrapped the body in linen. So what do you think it means when it says, why did the woman prepare these ointments? Verse 56 of Luke 23. Well, I'll tell you why they did. They saw the Lord placed in the tomb. They saw exactly how the body was laid. And what they also saw was that although the body had been wrapped in wrappings with myrrh and aloes, that the face and hands that were left exposed had not yet been anointed with ointment, as was the Jewish custom, and they determined that they would do something about that the very next morning. Now, I put it to you, my dear friends, if the woman saw into the sepulchre with enough detail to see that, I think they knew where the tomb was. Don't you? Do you want to see the verse that's quoted in support of the argument of the wrong tomb theory? Mark chapter 16. The gentleman that first propounded this theory, this was his passage used in evidence. Mark 16. Verse 5. And entering into the sepulchre, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. And now I'm going to read verse 6 in the way that this person read verse 6, who suggested the wrong tomb theory. He saith unto them, be not affrighted, ye seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him, pointing to another tomb. The only problem is that there were some words missed out. Some rather crucial words, actually, which are, by the way, in the Greek text of the gospel record, as far as we're able to determine, he is risen. Now, really what you've got there is a suggestion that totally manipulates the text of this particular document in order to support the view presented. And we would find that completely unacceptable in terms of the presentation of evidence. And of course, you realize this, that if the woman had made a mistake, then so also must Peter and John, because obviously they sent Peter and John off to the wrong tomb as well. And you see, if they'd all made that mistake, the woman and Peter and John, then the Jews, of course, would have been delighted to show the disciples the real tomb and to parade the corpse of Jesus before all and say, you went to the wrong place, but here he is, absolutely dead. But they didn't do that, and they couldn't do that. And the Romans, of course, the Romans, if they'd gone to check on the wrong tomb, could have produced the body as well if the disciples had made this particular mistake. But you see, the trouble with the whole wrong tomb theory is there was one person who never, ever, ever would have made a mistake. You know who that is? Joseph of Arimathea. Because he would say, I have paid for the tomb. I do know where it is. All right? Now, there's no possibility that there could be a mistake, really, is there, concerning where the tomb might be. Because this man owned the tomb. He knew. He knew where it was. There was no possibility that such a mistake could occur, because if it did, it would be quickly rectified and the body would be shown in a different tomb. Now, I think we can dispense with that idea as an explanation of the gospel evidence. What about this one? The theft theory. Theft theory is that either the Jews or the Romans stole the body. Well, I don't think the Jews did. Acts chapter 4. Come and have a look at this. Do you know that in Acts chapter 4 and verse 1, it says, "And as they spake unto the people, the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them, being grieved that they taught the people and preached through Jesus the resurrection from the dead." You see, what had happened in this particular episode is that the Jews had gone to extraordinary lengths to stop anyone from taking the body. What they were most concerned about was the statement of Jesus that he might just rise within 3 days. And the problem was that within just two months, Acts 4 tells us that the whole of Jerusalem was seething, positively seething on the matter of the resurrection of Jesus, and the Jews were furious about the matter. They were furious with the disciples of Christ. And you know, my dear friends, the one thing that the Jewish people could have done, that the Jewish leaders could have done, that would have destroyed the credibility of Christ, destroyed the credibility of the disciples, was to produce the body and show that it was absolutely dead, and they would have loved to have done that. Couldn't. You know why? Because they didn't have the body. That's why. They didn't have the body. Believe me, they would have produced it if they could. So what about the Romans? Do you think maybe the Romans stole the body? No, I don't think so. John 19. I don't think the Romans stole the body for a very good reason. Because in John 19, we're told this concerning the matter of the death of this particular man and his subsequent burial. In John 19 and verse 12, "From thenceforth Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, If thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. And when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat." You see, the fact of the matter is that Pilate had absolutely no interest in the body of Jesus personally. But I tell you what Pilate had an interest in. He had a very great interest in Caesar's opinion of him. And the problem with Pilate, my dear friends, was that at this particular time in his history, he was already in trouble with Rome over several Jewish matters of administration that he had handled very, very badly. And the last thing he wanted was another controversy in the middle of his governorship. The last thing he wanted was any further difficulties going back to Rome. The greatest interest that Pilate had was in keeping the peace. And given the agitation of this particular crucifixion and the story of the rumors that had circulated about this man and this body, the last thing that Pilate would have wanted was something that might blow the whole controversy wide open again. Oh no, I don't think the Romans wanted that body taken at all. They wanted it left firmly shut in that tomb. And when this uproar arose in Jerusalem, the Romans couldn't produce the body either. So what about this one? Oh, this is a good one, the hallucination theory. So maybe what had happened was, well, the theory is that after the death of Christ, that what happened was people had hallucinations concerning the risen Christ. That they really did think that they saw him, but in fact what was going on was a series of hallucinatory visions. Actually, hallucinations are quite tricky things to manage. Hallucinations require certain sort of things in terms of the atmosphere for them to occur. Actually, I tell you what, a really excellent place for hallucinations would have been in the empty tomb.
if you could have just got a few people into the empty tomb, and particularly as the sun went down and it grew dark and spooky, that would have been the very place to have hallucinations. The funny thing, though, is about the appearances of Christ in the divine record is they don't seem at all to match the notion of hallucinations. He appears on a road with some people walking. He turns up in a locked room. He appears on a Galilean mountain. He turns up on the shores of the lake. He appears early in the morning. He appears at evening time. He turns up in the broad daylight of the middle of the day. All the story of the appearances of Christ doesn't fit the notion or the idea of hallucinations. It's actually known that there are only certain types of people who hallucinate. They're generally highly strung. They're generally over-imaginative. They have a nervous and excitable disposition. And generally they also have this, and this is most important, they have a predisposition towards the vision they intensely want to see. And by the way, hallucinations are real enough to the person that has them. What happens is they desire it so much that in the end, an act of vision takes place for which there is no corresponding external object, but the person really believes that they've seen it. But you see, they've worked themselves up into such a fever of anticipation that in the end, the brain finally imprints a picture about something that's not really there. Now, do you think that the disciples of Christ had a predisposition towards seeing the risen Christ? No, I don't think so. Have a look at Mark 16, verse 1. Now, I don't think the evidence of the gospel records is satisfactorily accounted for by the idea of an hallucination. In Mark 16 and verse 1, it says this: when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome had brought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. What were the women coming to do? They were coming to anoint a dead body. They weren't ready to have a vision about a living body. They were coming to anoint a dead body. They had no predisposition towards a risen Christ, a living Christ, at all. Oh no, they firmly believed that he was dead. No predisposition towards this. Luke chapter 24. Luke 24 says this. This is an interesting one. Perhaps verse 36. Luke 24, verse 36. Were the disciples inclined towards having a hallucination? Were they so intensely desirous of seeing the risen Christ? Well, verse 36 of Luke 24, as they thus spake, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them and said unto them, peace be unto you. But they were terrified and affrighted and supposed that they had seen a spirit. They weren't expecting to see this person. None of the conditions leading to hallucination were there, quite the opposite. In fact, funny thing about this record is it says in verse 41, while they yet believed not for joy and wonder, he said unto them, have ye here any meat? And they gave him a piece of a broiled fish and of an honeycomb, and he took it and did eat before them. Pretty tricky hallucination that can eat meat. Matthew 28 that we read tonight in verse 9 says that when the woman first saw him, they held him by the feet. How do you hold a vision by the feet? Now, the gospel records clearly tell us that the appearances of Jesus were forced on the disciples against their will. They weren't inclined to the matter at all, and they involved the infallible tests of sight and sound and touch that verified absolutely that this was no vision, no hallucination. And let me tell you one final thing that's interesting about the hallucination theory. In the gospel records, we're told that at a certain time after his resurrection, the Lord Jesus Christ ascended into heaven. Do you know what happened to the apparent hallucinations? They switched off, just like that, the moment Jesus went to heaven. Isn't that strange? No more hallucinations. Funny thing with hallucinations, you know, once people start, it sort of rolls and it multiplies, and By this stage, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that had seen the risen Christ. How did they all switch off their hallucinations just like that? Never another one reported ever since. After Jesus ascended to heaven. You can't do that. You can't switch hallucinations off as quickly and as easily as that. No, they weren't hallucinations at all. That's not a good explanation of the evidence of the Gospels. Well, what about this one? Oh, this is a cracker. I do like this one. The swoon theory. Now, actually, this idea has come back into prominence in recent times, and it would be a view held amongst the Muslim community in many places. And the suggestion is that what happened is that Christ did not die, but he swooned on the cross. That medical knowledge was fairly primitive in those days, and that thinking the man to be dead, he was taken down and laid in the tomb, and that there the cool air and the aromatic spices revived him so that he was able to walk forth and to meet with his disciples again. But that in fact the Lord had not died at all. Now, I think that doesn't accord with the gospel evidence and the gospel records. The evidence is that he was dead, and the evidence certainly is that the cold stone slab and the suffocating spices, if they were going to do anything, they would have extinguished the man's life rather than revived him from a medical point of view. And there is a problem, you see, with the swoon theory. Come and have a look at John chapter 20. Now, do you remember the story of the linen clothes? That this man was wrapped and wrapped and wrapped and wrapped in these linen clothes with all these spices gummed together so that he's lying there almost like a sort of human sarcophagus on the stone slab. Now, remember, if he swoons, he's got to somehow then, well, what does it say in John chapter 20, verse 4? Both Peter and John ran together and they came to the sepulchre. Verse 5, and he stooping down and looking in saw the linen clothes lying, yet went he not in. Then comes Simon Peter following him and went into the sepulchre and seeth the linen clothes lie and the napkin that was about his head, not lying with the linen clothes, but wrapped together in a place by itself. You know, the remarkable thing is that when they went into the tomb, you see, they didn't just see the linen clothes, by the way. It says they saw the linen clothes lying. And I think that what the Gospels are telling us is that the linen clothes were still in the exact shape of the body, but simply dropped flat. It's as if the body should still have been there. There were the legs and the torso and the arms of all the wrappings, like an empty chrysalis. And the head napkin that was wound like a bandage around the head, still in the shape of a turban, but there was no head there. The body was gone. Now the crucial question, my dear friends, from John chapter 20 is, how did Jesus wriggle out of the clothes? Aha! Now there's a problem. Imagine that he had only swooned and that he revived in the tomb. The first crucial question is, how did he get out of those clothes? And then wrap them up all very carefully so that they looked undisturbed. Question one. Question two, and there is a very great problem with this theory, is imagine that Jesus is now revived and he's got rid of the linen clothes, the linen wrappings. There's still a problem, isn't there? The problem is he's inside the tomb and there's no way to get the stone channel on the outside to push the stone away. So how do you get out of a tomb when you're on the inside and the only way to push the stone is on the outside along the channel? Well, there was only one thing for it, but to go to the back of the tomb and to rush forward with both hands and to burst forth and push that great stone that 20 men could not roll away over. And of course, having got out there, there'd be the Roman guards, but that was no problem to Jesus. He would immediately deal with the Roman guards and dispatch the whole lot of them. Any more? And then, the record says, he would walk to Emmaus, a journey of about 7 miles on pierced feet, and then convince his disciples he was alive and well and healthy. What an amazing man he was. No, I don't think so. I don't think that you can account for the gospel details by means of the swoon theory at all. Well, there is one last one, and that's the fraud theory. Now, the fraud theory is, well, it's the theory of Matthew 28. So let's just come and have a look at Matthew 28, and because this was the Jewish theory, or the Jewish explanation. The fraud theory is that the whole trick was planned by the disciples. That the disciples stole the body, secretly buried Christ, and then went abroad and promulgated the story of his resurrection. And here it is, verse 13 of Matthew 28. They said to the soldiers, "Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept." So this was the Jewish story, that the disciples came while the Roman soldiers were asleep and stole them away. Of course, there's a terrible flaw in that story, isn't there? You know what the flaw is? The flaw is this. If the Roman soldiers were awake, then why didn't they stop the disciples? And if they were asleep, then how did they know it was the disciples? Now, you can't argue that one, can you? Can't have it one way and t'other way. Either they did or they didn't know. If they were awake so that they knew it was the disciples, why didn't they stop them? If they were truly asleep, they couldn't say it was the disciples because they couldn't have known because they were asleep. And you see, when you consider the gospel evidence of these men, frightened, demoralized, shattered, meeting in secret rooms for fear of the Jews at this particular time, do you really think that this group came, knocked out the guard, carried away the corpse, buried it, and then became the people that would change the world by their preaching of this doctrine that this man was truly raised from the dead? There's no explanation, my dear friends, for the psychological power that erupted from these transformed men that went forth and changed the world in which they lived. No, they were 100% convinced that this man was raised from the dead. So what's left? And there is nothing left, is there? There's nothing left in terms of theories or explanations that can really satisfactorily account for the gospel records, but that Jesus was raised from the dead. And I'd like to just quote a little quotation to you about the mighty significance, therefore, of this particular matter. One writer says, "The resurrection was God's intervention, thrusting into the course of nature and the system of earthly life. It was an evidence of power, power which is not limited even by the ordered sequence of events which he himself has established. God has openly revealed himself, cutting across the stream of human history, and what he has done, he can do again. The act is indeed directly connected with his past and future actions, with creation, with the virgin birth, and with the kingdom to be established. It is the evidence that what God has begun to do, he will bring to completion." Yes, my dear friends, we are in no doubt that Jesus is risen indeed, and that in him all the promises of God will find their absolute and perfect fulfillment with the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth. We believe it's real. We believe it's coming. We believe it soon, and we believe that Jesus, the risen Christ, will be at the head of all things that will transform the world from the place that we currently know it to a kingdom that will bring pleasure and honor to the mighty Creator of heaven. And there's a guarantee for all of this, which yet awaits us if we're prepared to read our Bibles, to pay attention to what God has asked us to do, and to make ourselves ready for the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ from heaven. There's a wonderful guarantee that all this will happen. And the guarantee is the guarantee of the Gospels. which in our view, my dear friends, we ask you to contemplate this, that they do indeed provide indisputable evidence that Jesus rose from the dead.